Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Greengage, the digital finance pioneer and first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. In this episode, host Sean Kiernan interviews Ted Brombach, founding partner at XMS Capital Partners. Ted shares his background and explains XMS's role as an investment banking, asset management and merchant banking firm. They discuss M&A advisory services, capital raising for companies, and Ted also talks about how XMS works with alternative asset managers to create new financial products.
Welcome back to another episode of The Gauge. I'm delighted to have Ted Brombach here with us, who's a founding partner at XMS Capital Partners. It's our first time to have somebody who's not just a specialist in the capital markets, but also someone who knows Bitcoin mining quite deeply, having engaged in a few transactions. Ted, it'd be great to hear your background and also kind of what XMS does.
Sure. And thank you for having me today. XMS Capital Partners is an investment banking, asset management, and merchant banking firm. I founded it 17 years ago with my co-founder, Yogi Spence. We came out of about a 16 or 17 year career at Morgan Stanley. We have offices in the UK and in the US. So we're in Chicago, Boston, Dallas, and over in London. We do, in the investment banking area, we do M&A advisory, buy side and sell side M&A advisory and capital raising for companies, both public securities and we raise private capital as well. We have an asset management business called XA Investments, XMS Alternative Investments, where we create financial products in the alternatives world. So think of us as working with alternative asset managers to create products, and they are sold in different distribution channels. So for instance, we have one stock that trades on the New York Stock Exchange. That's a U.S. below investment grade debt product managed by an asset manager called Octagon, which is being bought by Generali as we speak. We tried to put a U.S. or a North American farmland investing fund up on the London Stock Exchange. But when we were on the road, we ran into Liz Truss announcing her budget a little over a year ago, and the market really cratered at that moment. But you're going to see us coming out with some other interesting ideas here over the next 6 to 12 months. And then we do what we call merchant banking. So we invest our own money. We invest money with other investors. Into private deals. We put up a couple of SPACs in the States, you know, one of which we de-SPACed into Core Scientific, which is the biggest Bitcoin miner in North America, and the other one is in registration right now with an announced deal, which you can look up on the SEC.
Excellent. I'm not going to ask you for specifics on those transactions. Obviously, the SEC would take an interest otherwise. But I would love to hear from you some of the trends you've seen in your work in the particularly Bitcoin mining space, in terms of the companies that are doing things, the valuations of the companies. Are you seeing anything that you might be able to extrapolate for our listeners?
Yeah. So back a couple of years ago, there was a kind of a rush to get to the capital markets because Bitcoin mining essentially is a very capital intensive industry. And companies that were able to get public were able to raise capital more easily and frankly at lower cost of capital than the private companies. So there was a long period of time when these companies couldn't get public, and some of them literally reverse merged into companies that were doing something completely different at the time. So they went through some gymnastics to get public. And then there was a period of both capital raising, equity and debt, and M&A, so consolidation. And, you know, different companies had different strategic visions. Some looked to vertical integration. Some tried to extend what they were doing, both in terms of infrastructure and even use cases. I look at, you know, Riot Blockchain, for instance, changed its name to Riot Platforms to signify to the marketplace that they're expanding their strategic vision on what they're doing. But then, you know, you saw the price of Bitcoin fall dramatically from about 67,000 to around 16,000. And you saw the price of energy spike up. And, you know, in part that was due to world events, Russia invading Ukraine and whatnot. And, you know, people talk about a crypto winter. They talk about a second crypto winter. I guess I'll try to talk about a crypto winter in deals. So, you know, a lot of the companies were basically seeing that there was going to be no additional capital offered to the industry at anything like economic rates. And so the deal activity really slowed down very massively, you know, in Q1 2022. And I think the interesting point on that is that we are seeing that activity pick back up again. So you've seen Bitcoin rally, you know, kind of stayed at about 26,000 for a long time. And it's really moved pretty aggressively up into the mid-30s over the course of the past month or so. And we are seeing deal activity both on the buy side and the sell side in terms of digital infrastructure, I'll call it. And I think that there's an additional overlaying trend here of the next halving coming up. We predict the next halving will be next April. And what we have seen on the previous halvings is, you know, a period of weakness for a while. And then you start to see Bitcoin rally a bit going into the halving, and then substantially after that. And what happens with the halving is a lot of, you know, you and I were talking that the hash rate is the highest it's ever been, but you're going to see that come down a little bit after the halving because a number of the miners become uneconomic, and so they just literally shut off. And so this is what people are predicting. We're kind of seeing it happen. Whether it actually happens the way it happened the last few times, we don't know, but companies are trying to position themselves for that next very, very important event.
It's very interesting to see the halving and the repeat of the uptick in the price of Bitcoin happening around that. I'd love to break down the valuation metrics that firms like you look at for Bitcoin miners themselves. Obviously, you spoke about the financialization of the industry as it became more sophisticated, could get lower cost of funding if it went public. There are some other inputs in terms of the energy price, the price of the machinery, et cetera. What are the dynamics that kind of are the drivers of this industry from an institutional perspective to see what's the price of the company that is the biggest miner?
There's no one metric that drives it, of course. Valuation, people always point at metrics and it becomes more of a judgment call than a science. And different companies have taken different strategic views on, for instance, building infrastructure. But we look at a number of different metrics, but a key one that we look at, of course, is profitability. But we also look at enterprise value to owned infrastructure. So people are always talking about what they're going to build in the future. The market doesn't give you a lot of benefit for what you're going to build in the future because building in the future is not easy and expensive. But what you have in the ground and running is important. And so we look at how much Bitcoin you mine. We look at how much infrastructure you have, so how many megawatts you have in the ground. And by the way, those megawatts have multiple use cases, right? I mean, you don't just have to mine Bitcoin when you've got those megawatts in the ground. But we also look at profitability. We look at the capital structure of the company, how much risk, how much financial risk are they taking on? Because effectively in this industry, you got a number of volatile commodities, right? You've got Bitcoin, which itself is highly volatile. You have energy, which is highly volatile. And the last thing you need is to have a capital structure or an income statement that's highly volatile as well, because it's super levered. And you've seen a number of companies suffer because of that. So,
do you see many options for hedging risk?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I would say that 3 years ago, even some of the largest miners had what I would consider to be unsophisticated risk management controls or metrics internally. And over the course of the past 2.5 to 3 years, many of these miners have built out much more sophisticated ways to look at and control these highly volatile commodities that they're dealing with. I mean, it's almost like looking at, you know, a bank's dealing room now, seeing how they look at the risk that they're taking, how they hedge, how they use futures, how they negotiate their contracts with power providers, et cetera. It's getting much more sophisticated, which needed to happen.
Yes, it's a good thing, particularly if it's a listed company. I'd be curious, you mentioned the vertical integration as something that some of these firms are looking into. Obviously, energy production is one of the pieces that you could integrate into a value chain of a miner. The development of their own machinery or even equipment, or the energy cycling to use from the grid to actually the final chips. Are you seeing any best practice or commonality in business models, or is this still all over the place?
I do not see any best practices yet, but I do see that many of the companies are pushing the frontiers of what they're looking at, what they want to be 3 and 5 years from now. I don't think that there's any sort of one strategy that everyone is coalescing around. I do see, though, that, you know, figuring out ways to lower the huge CapEx spend that these companies have to bear is important, and increasing the use cases for Bitcoin in particular is becoming important. So I think that, you know, this next leg of where these companies are going is being formed as we speak. I think there, like I said, there was a big pullback over the course of the past kind of 18 months, and over the course of the past 6 months or so, they're kind of coming back out. Bitcoin has been stronger. The capital markets have been healing. I mean, the capital markets have been rough for everybody, not just Bitcoin miners or others. I mean, with interest rates rising the way they were, I mean, it's kind of like the music stopped in January of 2022, and it takes about 18 months plus. But I mean, we are seeing a lot of green shoots, if you will, right now. We're seeing a lot of activity with Bitcoin miners and with others. I mean, we just had a call from a very large U.S. hedge fund about a week and a half ago saying, hey, we're back in the market and we're looking to finance data centers and we're looking to finance Bitcoin miners and, you know, let us know what you guys are seeing. So yeah, that's very interesting. And I think that it's a long putt between a Bitcoin miner and a data center, but there's going to be convergence on those strategies over time as well.
It's a very interesting development. We'd seen in our discussions with some credit funds that are in the data center financing space that Bitcoin just didn't feature.
Yeah.
To hear that that's slightly tipping. I mean, this has been years in the making.
No, we were surprised to get the phone call. And these guys are quite large. The ones that called us are quite large. They're committing hundreds of millions of dollars at a crack. So
the lending rates you mentioned in 2021 were pretty abysmal for the miners, and that kind of froze up that area of infusion of monies. Are you seeing that kind of coming back, that they can borrow a bit more, maybe against equipment, energy, or the mined Bitcoin itself? Or is it still more of, when you say the unfreezing, is that more still an equity?
It's, you know, straight debt is still going to be expensive, although it's getting a little bit more reasonable. You know, the inquiry that we're getting would be sort of equity linked. So, you know, they're not going into the common equity, but they're going to be in some sort of a preferred structure where they're getting yield. And, you know, when you're mining Bitcoin, you're actually making money if you've got your cost structure right. But then they want the, you know, the optionality, the upside optionality for an equity investor has a lot of value. And that's what they're trying to play. They're trying to get some current yield. They're trying to be above the equity capital structure, but they're trying to get that upside optionality.
We've discussed energy. That's another kind of theme that has been touched on a lot around Bitcoin and the extraction of energy to yield Bitcoin being an impact on the environment. Is this something that the particularly listed companies are looking to address in their business models? Or is this something that, again, you're seeing any trends on that might be worth mentioning?
Well, let me take a step back, because I think it's really, really interesting. I mean, first of all, obviously, we are trying to go to a more green economy. You had the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, which has massive subsidies for wind and solar. You know, the issue and the problem is that these things take a long time, and we're going to be with fossil fuels for a long time. But Bitcoin is really interesting in that, you know, the problem with a lot of renewables is that the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine at the times that huge users, big cities, need it. Bitcoin, well, you know, and so let's say you put a wind farm out in West Texas. There's no big city out in West Texas where to use the energy. Now you've got to transport it. You got to store it. You got to do all this stuff. Bitcoin's interesting in that you can put the wind farm up in West Texas and you can create a globally tradable commodity called Bitcoin, created with renewable energy where the wind is blowing and the sun is shining. So that infrastructure will continue to grow. It's just in its kind of infancy right now, or maybe it's young adulthood. And, you know, I'm a continued believer in Bitcoin. I think that it's going to continue to grow. One of the things we were talking about is, you know, the market value of Bitcoin right now is about $715 billion. That would make it the ninth largest publicly traded company in the world. It's going to, in my opinion, going to continue to increase in value. And so people are going to make use cases. But we're still so early on in that infrastructure development. But, you know, Bitcoin has a number of different use cases, which we can, you know, talk about. And there are lots of people that know a lot more about it than I do. But, you know, if you think about the intersection of Bitcoin and renewable energy, it's a very efficient way to use that energy in places where you can actually create it. and solve some of those problems of, hey, the wind's not blowing in, you know, I don't know what, downtown Miami when they need it.
You could almost liken it to being a battery where instead of it taking energy as an output, you take value, and the value can then be reinserted back into an equation.
Right. You can look at it as you're storing alternative energy value in a globally traded commodity called a Bitcoin, and, you know,
which
doing what you want with it.
Help to offset the cost of building the site. We've gone into the weeds, really, of Bitcoin mining as such, which is essentially the plumbing. And you mentioned the asset price itself and the trends. The use cases around Bitcoin are, as you said, still early days. Obviously, people have hearkened it to digital gold on one level, so as an asset in its own right. Are there any changes you're seeing in terms of your business and engagement with more broadly crypto assets or Bitcoin specifically? Merchant banking, capital markets activities, these are very long-lasting industries that have kind of been a very people-led business for centuries, basically. How do these worlds come together, if at all? Or is this just another asset class that's emerging?
Well, I would say we sit in a privileged chair where our job is to sit down with entrepreneurs and leaders of companies, and they explain to us what they've been working on and how they're working on it. And their question to us is, you know, can you help us finance it? Can you help us find strategic partners? Can you help us find customers? Because, you know, for instance, we have reach into North America that a lot of, you know, London-based companies don't. And, you know, those are very interesting conversations. We see a lot of innovation going on, an incredible amount of innovation going on. In fact, in fintech broadly, and I would consider Bitcoin to be part of kind of the fintech family, the innovation in London is incredible because you've got this financial infrastructure of people, if you will, that have been focused on the international markets for decades, maybe hundreds of years. And, you know, along comes Brexit, and there's this decoupling going on. And so when you've got all this financial sophistication and all this financial entrepreneurialism, you know, there's a look at, okay, we're decoupled from Europe. Where do we go next? We're going to stay in Europe, but we're also going to look to the U.S. And so we've been having all these conversations about what does that look like? And what I would say is we see an incredible amount of innovation, and it kind of spins your head in terms of thinking about how can I apply this in my business? But what I would also say is, you know, we're in, I don't know what the UK analogy would be, but we're in inning number one. It's baby infancy in terms of where these companies are going. But sometimes you sit in these meetings and your jaw is agape when you look at what people are doing in the innovation, the technology, AI. They're using AI, you know, Bitcoin use cases. There are literally hundreds of Bitcoin use cases being built using layers of the protocols of how Bitcoin was set up. You know, these things take a lot of money, they take a lot of time, and they take a lot of, you know, a lot of people trying to wrap their minds around it. And so it's going to take some amount of years before you see a lot of it.
It's interesting. It's not even necessarily the technology itself. It's the way that the standards are set or the community engages with it that can build a solution. It's great to hear, I mean, from your experience that you're one of the few, I think, capital markets advisory firms that are getting stuck in getting to know the community and what's emerging. You mentioned...
The community is a lot of fun, by the way.
Yeah, interesting people and a lot of characters.
A lot of characters. Yeah.
You mentioned the changes that might be happening in terms of the financial services side. Do you think for your business specifically, I don't know if it's blockchain or AI or Bitcoin, but do you think there's any changes you foresee for a firm like yours in the next decades?
There's 100% probability that our firm will change based on some of the innovation that we're seeing with AI, with fintech, with blockchain. I think that how it's going to change is still a little bit to be seen. I think that we're going to look back 10 years from now and say, can you believe we used to do that? Like with, you know, four analysts sitting in the back room cranking through numbers, and now we're just pushing buttons and seeing all this stuff happen. I think we're going to see that. You know, the fact that even when we raise capital, a number of phone calls we have to make, the paperwork that goes into it, the costs of setting up vehicles. I mean, it is the clunkiest system you can imagine when you're in the bowels of it working away. And we've been talking to many, many companies who are coming at it, trying to innovate many of these processes, whether it's investing in public equity securities, public debt securities, setting up SPVs, reaching out to potential investors, monitoring investments for investors, et cetera, et cetera. It's the clunkiest thing you'll ever see in your life, but and there's a lot of innovation. Who is going to actually prevail in that innovation? That's, you know, picking those winners and losers is going to be, you know, an interesting thing to watch over the next couple of years. But it's happening right now. It's not in the future. It's happening right now.
My last question is on the international landscape. You are an international firm. You've got operations in the US, the UK, and obviously expertise globally. In terms of this innovation, do you think anyone's doing it well? And I know the lot of the listed miners specifically, primarily in the US these days.
Yeah.
Is that a trend you think will continue?
Well, I mean, I have a couple things to say on that. Number one, I think the innovation in London is incredible. And the innovation around the universities in the UK is incredible. I mean, it's not just fintech or digital infrastructure. It's life sciences coming out of Oxford and Cambridge. It's you know, there's a lot of great stuff going on. The issue is when you get to the States, the market is just so large. People don't really understand. And there's this commentary that goes on, there's the US and there's the China and there's the EU and whatever, right? And President Xi said in 2021, I think he said that, you know, the East is rising, the West is sinking, or whatever he said. And since then, his economy, you know, has been, you know, the U.S. has outgrown China. So when he said that, Chinese economy was 75% of the U.S. Now it's 64% of the U.S. GDP. That means that it has to grow 50% to equal the U.S. GDP. Point being that when you're raising capital, whether you've got the best entrepreneur in the world doing it in London, when you're raising capital, the depth of the capital markets in the U.S. and the cost of capital in the U.S. is just unmatched by anybody in the world. There are lots of bad trends going on, you know, huge budget deficits and high costs of an aging population, all that. But still, you know, the U.S. GDP is roughly $27 trillion. You know, China's is roughly $19-some trillion. So there's just a huge disparity. And then when you get to Europe, it's even different. So when you say who's doing it better, there's incredible innovation going on, all over Europe. I'm going to the continent actually tomorrow. Stuff we've seen, like I said, around the universities here and in London. But when it comes to financing and getting the financings done, getting the deals done, doing it at the lowest cost of capital, I think the U.S. is, you know, still a place where you want to be.
Good. Well, here's to working in partnership. Ted, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Sean.
On.